Howdy, friends. This is Annie Fonte, and you are listening to the Badass Soul Seeking Warrior podcast. On each episode, I chat with a different guest and ask them to share their stories about what they were doing before they decided to redesign their life, what they're doing now, and how they navigated through the challenges and events in their life to get to where they are today. What realizations and transformations did they experience? What fears did they overcome? And ultimately, how did they create a life that they love? Okay, my friends, you are in for a treat today. Here at the Badass Soul Seeking Warrior podcast, we focus on three things: entrepreneurship, leadership, and most importantly, creating a life that you love. And my guest today has vast experience in all of these areas. I promise we're going to have an empowering, inspiring, and enlightening conversation with today's guest, Angela Scott. Angela is the founder of the Office of Angela Scott, which is a company funded, founded, and operated by women. She designs footwear for women who mean business and is stepping into the 13th year of being in business herself. Welcome, Angela, and thank you for saying yes to me for the second time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So one of my favorite things to do, in addition to having these really robust conversations with my guests, is doing the research prior to having the conversation, because I like digging up as much goodness and things that I think will really inspire and will be valuable to our audience as possible. So I want to start at the very beginning here, Angela. You're the youngest of your siblings. You have one biological brother and two foster brothers. Your biological mother is schizophrenic, and you've never met your biological father. At one point in your young age, you lived in a car prior to entering into the foster care system, and you consider your foster parents your mom and dad. So I'm curious, we all have a story. Some of these stories from our childhood can be very inspiring and wholesome, and others can be very challenging and full of some kind of tragic things. And yours was more on the challenging side here. So I'm curious how having this upbringing has affected you in the past and how it continues to affect you today.
I think in the past, I don't know if I was too young or naive to remember how it's affected me in the past, because I thought I had a great childhood. Like, I know that I was in a court half the time. I know that I was working with social workers half the time, that we had supervised, you know, doctor's appointments, that, you know, that I had this woman who was my biological mother, you know, having visitation rights. And I had all of that, but I don't know if it was just the environment that my foster parents created for me, but I thought I had a great childhood. Like, I didn't feel like I was suffering or that there were any impacts that I felt like it was kind and giving. Now, there were moments where I may have been confused, where my biological mother may have leaned in a little harder, asking, you know, saying that, you know, we would live together again someday. So there were moments that were confusing, but I feel like overall it was a good experience. I think as I got older, some of those things kind of reared their head. You know, I guess you'd say is that like those idiosyncrasies become part of who you are in the future, and you don't realize what an impact it's going to have on your adult life. But I still feel like the takeaways are really that I'm quite observant of people. I've had to have a lot of people observing me in my life. So I've had to be very cognizant of who comes in and who comes out and who's trustworthy. So I think my past has really shaped me to be aware, but it also has put up a wall of trust. Like, it takes a lot for me to garner trust from people. Sure. So I think that could be part of the, I guess you'd say, a negative side of it, but also it makes me perceptive to people. And it also makes me very, I'm an empath. So I think having grown up, you know, dealing with certain circumstances like that, you realize that everybody is trying their hardest. You know, I watch so many people try incredibly hard to do what they were doing and navigate a really tricky situation, from the social workers trying to navigate, am I being hurt? Am I in a safe environment? You know, my mother, biological mother, trying to navigate I want to be a mother, but I'm not capable. My foster parents navigating this schizophrenic biological mother trying to take back her children. So I think what it did in totality was to really make me strong and empathetic for this journey of ours, this life journey. Like everybody's doing their best at what they can and what they've been given.
Yeah, I agree with that. We do the best with the tools that we have. What age were you when you went into foster care?
I was in the orphanage. I think I was about like almost turning two, and then we were in the orphanage for several months, and then at 2 and a half, I went to our foster family.
Wow, so you were really young.
And I don't even remember the first time I was told. It's actually a question that I might ask my mom is like, when did you tell me that I was a foster child? I don't remember.
Wow, that's interesting. And in your case, as you, especially as you got older and reflected back, it would be really easy to start telling a story of victimhood. But you chose differently for yourself. And I'm curious how your biological mom and your foster mom interacted with one another, and if there was any rubs there, any conversation around who's the mom and those kinds of things that could be tricky given their roles.
Yeah, I mean, it was a conversation that I had just recently with my foster mother, is that my biological mother was tough. She was really tough on my foster mother, accused her of being a bad mother, reminded her that she wasn't the mother. She fought really hard, my biological mother did, to make an impression on my foster mother that she did not have authority, nor was she the matriarch of the family. And I have to say that my foster mother, she's kind of your very we came from a low class to middle, low income family, and she just has a way about her. She's the croc wearing sweatpants, crochet. Like she's just such a soft woman that you wouldn't realize how strong she is. I think I underestimated how strong my foster mother was until I learned the story about her. I mean, I remember as a teenager, I'd get angry, and there was one moment where I really hated my biological mother. I thought that I hated her. And I remember saying to my foster mother how much I hated her. And she just goes, you don't hate her. You love her, and she loves you so much. She's just not capable of taking care of you. For somebody to have an advocate for a woman, right, who has created such a trouble in her life, and then to stand there and advocate for her to her daughter is commendable. I thought that was really incredible of my foster mother to be able to advocate for my biological mother, and tell me the good things about her.
Yeah, and it gave you such a beautiful example of integrity and appreciation for, as you said earlier, people do the best they can with what they have. And your foster mother never put your biological mother down or
Never.
tried to step in front of her in any way. So that's a pretty remarkable person for sure. But yeah, you had this, what you remember as a really fun and playful and adventurous upbringing. And then you decided at some point that you were going to matriculate and go to college, and you chose to be an English major. And so your choice of becoming an English major, what was that driven by? Did you want to teach? Did you like to read books? Were you interested in the arts?
It was both. I really, really love reading. I mean, still to this day, if I stop reading, it impacts my health. I have to dive into a novel. So like I try to read at least two books a month, that at minimum. But so reading was really important to me. I thought I wanted to be a teacher because I really loved children. I really loved being around kids. I loved the development. I love education. But it was funny because as soon as I went to college, I am not a great student. I didn't have the capacity of attention span. Like I probably am a little bit ADHD, but I'm more of a creative. And so for me, test taking and things of that nature was really difficult. I would have to read a question over and over and over again. And then I'd get frustrated because I wasn't reading it, I wasn't understanding it. But I'm very good with the arts and I'm very good with creative. So I think the English major was definitely to teach. And then when I went to college, I realized, oh, maybe this isn't my pathway.
It's interesting you say that the creative side of you made it challenging for you to study and focus and whatnot. And I think one of the things that I would, appreciate more in the school systems if they don't label these kids that are a little antsy and they like to draw and their mind kind of wanders as having ADHD. I think if they allowed them, let's go in the corner and I'm going to give you a coloring book or some markers or some scissors and paper and go do your thing for a while. And really, unfortunately, they don't have the time to do that these days. But I think in our school systems, if there was more allowing these kids to color outside of the lines
Yeah.
and be who they authentically are instead of forcing them into a fit of, no, you need to learn your math and your alphabet and all those are important things, but at the same time giving them a little bit of room to spread their wings and be who they really are.
Yeah, that flexibility, it's really interesting because I think a lot of children fail in the school systems because they're not built for that type of structure. They can't thrive in that because that's not something that their brain understands how to take into part and pieces and build something out of. And I think also the pressure of that structure too, it makes it really difficult for somebody who's a little bit more creative and because they see things differently. They don't see things maybe linearly. They see them, my husband's dyslexic, and it's the same thing there. It's this, they don't see it, they don't read it, they don't understand it, they don't interpret it the same way. Doesn't mean that they're not intelligent, just means that they
Oh,
think differently.
brilliant minds, for sure. And well, you stayed true to yourself because you stayed on the creative side of things. But before you got to your business, you through some internships and whatnot with a shoe business, I believe is one of them, and then also construction companies, you found yourself eventually on construction sites, and you were struggling to walk through the terrain a little bit in your pencil skirts and appropriate attire for the powerful woman in those days and your heels. And I'm curious how those internships and then your time in the construction business, how that impacted you having a desire to one day create your own company and go into this designing of shoes.
It's funny because when I look back at it now, I didn't realize that it wasn't it that those experiences were not just building my desire to get into fashion to create a type of footwear, a specific type of footwear, but it was also creating the foundation for what the company stands for, the Women Who Mean Business.
Yes.
Because I was in an environment, most of the environments that I was in were all male driven, especially the construction business. It's a male dominant industry. When you're on those project sites and things of that nature, it's all men. And I realized that, fast forward to when I was in the business, that it was really the foundation of sort of wanting to make shoes to where I could walk in stride with these men. So it was not just the product, but it was also like the concept and the idea of being, not only am I going to create a product that I can walk comfortably in, look chic, be a badass woman, but I'm going to be walking in stride with these men versus running to try to keep up with them. Like literally and metaphorically, like I am going to be keeping up with them, like it by building this footwear brand. And I'm going to help other women do the same. And it's really happened that way.
Yeah, it really has. But before you started your business, you moved from California to Texas. That's where your husband was. And you started working in the public relations arm with Neiman Marcus. And how did that impact, if at all, any influences on your now company or your starting the office of Angela Scott?
I think it was a little bit of seeing behind the curtain. Everybody on the outside, when we go to a department store or when we're looking in a magazine or when we see fashion from the outside, you see the glamour, you see the beauty, you see that it's big, you see this sort of expansive idea. And when you're behind the curtain, like on the Neiman Marcus side, I got to know individual brands and I started understanding how small they were. So what appeared to be these big luxury brands were actually small family-run businesses that were being shipped out of garages, right? And it really gave me the confidence to understand that if you have a love and if you have a passion and an idea, that it's absolutely possible. You know, and before I had that experience in Neiman Marcus, I think I got in my own way thinking, yeah, I had interned at Deckers. I understand what a footwear brand was, but again, that was a big machine. And there were so many employees and there were so many parts and pieces to it that I still, at that stage, before I had gone to Neiman Marcus, I didn't understand that it was possible. You know, and then at Neiman Marcus, it gave me that clarity to go, okay, I could do this. I could try this. There are other people. There are tons of other brands that are really doing it in a very small, siloed, family-run, family-operated sort of environment. And that's something that I wouldn't have had I not experienced that at Neiman Marcus. So that was I was there for just a year, but it was a very pivotal year.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that. And that this is such a good segue into, I want to read to our audience a recent Instagram post that you put on social media. And so for all you entrepreneurs out there, for all you folks who have run up against a wall and you're a little bit of have a little bit of frustration going, I want you to listen to this. And we're going to talk more about this with Angela when I'm done. So here we go. By the end of 2010, we spent just about everything we had in our savings on molds, shoe samples, and printing business cards and line sheets. And now it was time to test proof of concept. I'd learned pretty quickly if we were actually had shoes that would resonate with the buyers or be a total flop. I would knock on hundreds of doors without an appointment, with a catalog in one hand and shoe samples in a bag in the other. It was a disaster. So many no's, not even no thank yous, just straight up no's. And that was even before I could show them the shoes. I thought I understood what it meant to have a tough skin, but my skin felt paper thin after just a dozen appointments. So many faces of disappointment or distaste. I was an interruption or a bother until I wasn't. I was afraid of every door I walked through, but I did it anyway. Talk more about that, because that you really had to face a no after no after no and keep putting one foot in front of the other to get to this place that you knew you could eventually get to.
And I mean, there were days. I remember the first few appointments or the first few, stores that I walked into, getting back to my room and just crying, just in tears, like feeling so defeated. Not just for the no, but the way the no came across. The no's coming across in the sense that I'm an idiot for even trying. That like, how dare I think that I'm interesting enough to be able to walk through that door? And that was the hard part, but I felt convicted, like, and I had this concept. I knew that it was good, like, and I was going to try every door just to see if it was. And even if just one said yes, that would validate me. And I think that the drive to continue going, even though it was, I mean, it's horrible. Like it really does kind of jump on your spirit. You know, you feel like you're just being pounded every time you go in there. And you have people too that are maybe told, see the appointment, see the shoes, and you could just see they're doing it out of a favor for somebody else, and they're not even paying attention. And it really puts a damper in your spirit, but it also puts a fuel to your fire. Like it's one of those things that like the more no's I got, the more determined I was to find the person that would say yes. And I think that's what fueled it to keep going. And again, if I got to the end of the rope, if I got to the end of the stores and nobody said yes, then that's something I'd have to face,
Yeah.
right? But I wasn't going to stop midway through. Like I wasn't going to quit because a few people hurt my feelings.
I love that. Reminds me of a quote I really love, and it's that they if they keep saying no, and it's just because they don't understand my question yet. You get to
Exactly.
yes, I just have to reconfigure my question to them. I'm curious, were these people who turned you away, buyers that were turning you away or saying no to you, were they men and women, mostly men?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It was a mixture. It was a mixture. The buyers were really a mixture because a lot of the stores at that time were owner owned and
Yes.
run. Like in the early, 2009, 10, 11, like in that generation, it was mostly boutique stores, the bigger retailers. But I would say that the buyers are for the bigger retailers, they were men, and for the smaller boutiques, they were usually women.
And did they give you, I know you got a lot of no's, but did any of them give you any input as to, I don't like the styling, they're too expensive, the construction isn't, was there anything that they gave you that
There was a word that was used a lot, directional. And
direction?
I remember looking it up and being like, directional, it means that it has like a certain point of view. And I'm thinking, isn't that a good thing? And it was so confusing because they all used it. Like it was very consistent. It was one word that was used time after time after time again. Oh, they're too directional. So it was almost like I had too much of an opinion. Like I had too specific of an idea. Which was interesting to me. And that is also a little bit why I kept going too, because I was like, it just hasn't yet hit yet. I think I'm before the trend. So
Yeah.
if I just wait a little longer, they're going to understand what this direction is, because it's just not here yet. It's something they haven't seen yet. So.
And I think, sometimes I think you can't be all things to all people, which I think that's true. But I think it's good to really hone in and focus in your branding and in your presentation of your product in your case or your services in other cases. Who is your audience? Who are you wanting to serve? And you really then started to formulate that community that you've developed, this office of Angela Scott, or these women that are powerful and they're out making big contributions in the world and they're doing big things in the world. And so it eventually got to that point. It'd be interesting to go back and talk to those buyers now and see what they might have to say about what you've been able to accomplish.
You know what? It's cute. It actually is really reassuring because in recent times I've been getting onto LinkedIn and I've been writing posts on LinkedIn kind of about the journey because I think it's really important to share that. I realize like at this stage, it'd be really nice to be able to share what I did and the ups and downs that might help somebody else who's going through the journey now to understand or to have somebody as a mentor to sort of say, oh, okay, that's what they did. I can do the same. So I started telling my story on LinkedIn and it's interesting because buyers, showrooms, they've all sort of reached out in a really positive way. And it's been really lovely. Like, oh, I've been watching you. Congratulations. So it's like they almost knew there was something. Maybe they couldn't believe in it. And then, but like it is swinging back around. And it's really fascinating to have that encouragement in a positive way, even now.
Yeah, and I love your posts on LinkedIn, and we'll put your all your social media links on the in the show notes. There, your insights and the things that you share are just wonderful. And I think for especially the entrepreneurs out there, and especially female entrepreneurs out there, I would suggest that they go and follow along and go back and read all of your posts because they're really empowering and they have a lot of value in them for sure. So you were talking about your year with Neiman Marcus and how when you pulled back the curtain, you were really surprised that these, what felt as they're out on the shelves and in the showrooms, like big brands, and they had all kinds of backing behind them, but they really didn't. And you actually bootstrapped the first couple of years of your company. You were doing all the designing, you were taking the photos, you were doing the marketing, you were doing accounts receivable, accounts payable, you were customer service, you were shipping and labels, you were doing it all. So talk about that because I think especially if you're wanting to start a company out there, anybody in our audience, or some of you are just starting, you're starting to find out that you wear a lot of hats, especially in the beginning.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've been doing some mentorship. Like I take, our appointments with different women that have reached out to me for mentorship, and the biggest question is, what do I need to get started? And I said, you need an idea, you need a conviction, but you also have to understand you're going to have to do it all yourself. Unless you have the funding, which is a different type of business to start, is if you start with funding or you start without it. If it is your own money, you're going to have to put your time and effort into it. And I had a job at the time because I started this while I was working at Neiman Marcus, and then I did a little bit of consulting too as I started doing the do building the business. So I always had a second job when I started the business. And I would say to entrepreneurs, You have to be prepared to learn every aspect of a business and to want to understand every aspect of a business. There is no such thing as not understanding what a P&L is.
Right.
You should know what a P&L is. You should know what a balance sheet is. You should know and understand what profitability is. You should understand what cost of goods are. There are all these elements into it that it's not just drawing pretty pictures and then having a shoe come to fruition and picking colors, right? It really is about business development. But I couldn't have wanted it to be in any other way because I feel like having all of those under your belt, understanding marketing, business development, operations, budgeting, finance, forecasting, design, like all of that is so integral to being a good business owner because when you start hiring people to do those jobs, you know what it takes to do those jobs. So not only do you have empathy for understanding how much work it is to do that specific job, but you also understand what it takes. What it requires. So when you're looking for a candidate, you know what to look for because you know what were the highs and lows for you as somebody who had to understand something that maybe wasn't your forte.
Yeah, this is so good. I'm an entrepreneur too, and I agree wholeheartedly with everything you say is to really understand every aspect of your business. Now, you may not be the best person for that job in the long run, but you do have a basic foundational understanding of it. So it gives you some guidepost when you're building a team or you're doing more design or whatnot. So I think that's really good advice, and I think it's good to come from that aspect versus if you're highly funded right out of the gate, because with that comes a board of advisors and potentially a board of directors and a vice president here and a C something over there. You end up being just lost in the shuffle because that you might have this really great idea, and then all these people come storming in and say, okay, here's how we're going to do things now. And it right out of the gate, it takes your entrepreneurial spirit away and all the things that your creativeness goes out the window because a flock of other people come in and think that they know how to drive your business. And sometimes maybe they do, but I think it's really a beautiful experience to go through the way you did it from you doing everything and then building the business up. So I'm curious, how many folks, how many gals do you have working with you today?
There's 15 of us now.
15. That's
Yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Oh,
Yeah.
that's
All women.
all women, for sure. That's good growth over 13 years. It's almost
It
a year, a person a year.
is. It is. And I think too, it's one of those things where like it kind of just to go back to what you're saying about if you were to have somebody come in and have big financing or have, funding. I think understanding all aspects of your business, especially as a woman, especially in the areas of operation and finance and understanding contracts and agreement is so important. It really
Yes.
is. It really is. And I think a lot of those things get devalued because you're like, oh, I don't understand it, so I'm not going to try. And I think it's really important to try to understand those parts of your business because as you do get bigger, and if you do have investment like that, you need to understand what the parameters are and what that means. And it also gives more women in positions of power strength because strength comes when you understand those aspects of the business. Those are the turning points. Those are the strength points. Those are what are going to get you on a board, right? Those items and understanding those values in a company are what's going to put you in a board seat for the future for a different company to be able to add value to another company. Because, right now women are getting put on boards to fill a seat, but wouldn't it be even more exceptional if it was because we had the credibility and it wasn't just because it was filling a seat? It was because we understood just as much, if not more, than what is needed to add value to that board seat because we built our businesses in a certain way.
And that's what I love so much. And I think we're starting to turn the corner a little bit on this. I love so much to talk to women who sit on boards or go into a situation where I've experienced different boards and there's women on those boards. It's not, don't put a woman on the board to check a box. Put a woman on the board because she's the best person to be on that board.
Correct. Yeah, because she's best suited for it. I've always believed that the right people for a job, for a board seat, are there because they know how to do the job. that they're there because they're qualified, and they're there because they are the best for the position, you know?
And that's important. A really solid board who it can cover a lot of ground as far as a company going through growth stages or whatever stage they're in. Maybe they're in a refresh stage, or maybe they're an older company and they need to figure out how they're going to stay relevant. But having the best people in all of those slots is so important, and it's especially important, I think, to have the female influence.
I do.
There's a lot of things that we just innately bring to the table, and not that men don't bring their own powerful things
Sure.
to the table too, but I think when the two come together and work together, then you really have something brilliant to work with.
100%. I mean, 100%. I think that both can add value, having men that advocate for women in those positions, having women advocate for women.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, let's get to your creative side here. Where does your design inspiration come from for your shoes?
The majority of my design inspiration really comes from like art, architecture, the automobile industry, vintage cars. Like I have a really, really strong love. I live in a different era. Like I love vintage anything. I think that there's something really palpable about the way that automobile design was, 50 years ago. I think there's just something so interesting to the way that the colors, the color palettes, the stitching and detail in the seating. Like I love everything having to do that. And art and architecture. I mean, you could see like behind me, I'm obviously like I love anything that has color and graphics and graphic elements. So that's really where the main inspiration comes from for my footwear.
Now it makes sense because I love architecture as well. I'm not as much of a car buff as you are, but I can understand where you look at the curve of a car or the lines of a car or a building or the different shading that it takes on from a color aspect. So that makes sense that you could get a lot of inspiration from that. And you do a beautiful job. Your shoes are just unbelievable. So speaking of that, how long does it take for you from pillar to post to design a new shoe?
A shoe can be as fast as 5 minutes on a napkin, where you just come up with an idea. I've had moments where I've had a dream and I had to wake up in the middle of the dream and keep a notepad near my nightstand so that I could write down. Some of the times I'd scribble something and go, why did I write that? Like, what did that mean? What did that word mean? Because maybe I would describe the shoe. So it could be as quick as 5 minutes for a shoe design to come to fruition, or as long as a year to develop something that I launched a sneaker that's called the Elliot recently, and it took me a long time because one, sneakers isn't our wheelhouse. Like we're mostly Oxfords and boots and mid heels and that sort of Goodyear welted construction. This was a shoe that wasn't Goodyear welted construction. This was a sneaker, and I had some nostalgia with like what I would wear when I was a teenager, and I wanted to bring that into this shoe. So it took over a year for me to. From design to getting to like the right pattern to developing it to changing the different patterns over and over again until I landed on what we have now. So it could take up to a year.
And that's another important thing for us all to remember is these things don't happen overnight sometimes. We have to be patient with ourselves and maybe set it aside for a little bit and go work on a different shoe or something, because to get to the ultimate goal of I don't like the word perfect, but the ideal shoe, it's a process. It takes some
It.
time sometimes. And then, who knows, maybe you come up and then 3 hours, you've got one, but to give yourself the grace for the process. How many shoes, different shoe styles do you design a year? Does it matter to you? Do you say, I want to do five this year, or?
I mean, there's we obviously there like as you get bigger, there's a cadence where we have a certain SKU count that we want to meet. So anywhere from 20 to, 45 designs a year, but a lot of them will get dropped. A lot of them, and like you said, like having patience, like I can't tell you how many I put on a shelf and then come back to years later, seasons later, going, I still want to do that shoe and I don't know why it's right. Let's revisit that one more time. So, I'd say anywhere from like 25 to 45 different styles a year.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is. It is. And again, not all of them get made, but like we definitely design and develop to get to a certain point where we know we're going to have a little bit of dropout.
Yeah, I think I was reading in one of the articles about you that your high top, the Gemma, I think it's called the Gemma.
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 It's what that was a 9 year kind of coming into the, you wore high tops when you were growing up and you always loved them. And so it took a while for that to cook.
Yeah. Well, and we had done these slip-ons early on in the business with the brand, like these slip-on really cute little canvas sneakers, really, really early on with the iconic stripes. And I had developed a high top that nobody ever saw that was with that collection. So it sat there for years. And what ended up actually becoming the high top wasn't that pattern. It was a totally different pattern, but that high top always sat there for, for a long time waiting for me to make it, So you never know when the right avenue and or the right timing is going to be, but it just feels instinctually right. The moment you have it, you go, okay, this is it. Now it is. Now it's time,
It's kind of like that saying, I love quotes and sayings, it's whatever's for you will never get past you. So if it sat on that shelf for 5 or 6 years, it was still for you. It just wasn't its time to be for you yet.
So true. So true.
Okay, once you get these shoes designed, how long does it take to make a pair of shoes?
So a pair of shoes usually would, t I mean, it could take up to a week. You really want a shoe the way that we make them in the Goodyear style. Like you really want them to sit on the last and form for some time. Things get rushed depending on, production and things of that nature. It's not always that case, but it takes quite a long time for that process. There's so many parts and pieces to a Goodyear welted shoe. I think people think that it's sort of a turn and burn that you can just do it in, but there's not. There's so many people involved and so many steps involved that it takes about a day to do all of the patterning and the cutting and the sewing and the stitching. And, but I mean, I would say if I were being honest, it would take about a week to get a shoe really done. And that's through all the way to the finishing in its box with the laces, ready to go.
Ready to go. So you've mentioned it a couple of times, and I want our audience to understand what Goodyear welting is.
So Goodyear welting, there are a few ways to do shoes, but the main way that shoes are made is they're glued together. So you've got the upper part of the shoe, and then you've got the sole, and you've got the midsole, and basically in most constructions, those two pieces they're just glued together. So that's just glued together. In Goodyear welt construction, there's a welt, which is like a rand. It's a long piece of leather that basically goes around the sidewall of the shoe, and it is sewn together to the upper, and then that is then sewn to the outsole. And so it's a very traditional. It traditionally in men's footwear, but it's a very traditional construction, and it's kind of an art form that's being that's kind of disappearing a little bit. And it's an art form that was mostly for men. I mean, there are very, very, very few companies that make Goodyear welted shoes for women, and I really wanted that construction because once you stitch a shoe that way, once you sew a shoe that way, you can resole that shoe. So you can give it to a cobbler, and a good cobbler will know the shoes, like, and will go, oh, these are really well made. But they can take the sole off and resole a new sole onto that shoe, which is a really great. So it kind of for me, it's sustainability.
Yeah,
I
and you can wear these shoes your entire life if you take really good care of them. And do you have a list of cobblers in different parts of the country that if a client says, I want to get my shoes redone, or can they send them back to the company? Do you guys do resoling?
We don't do resoling yet. It's something that I want to do. It's a program that I want to do. It's difficult when it's so far and few between. Like there hasn't been a big need for it yet, but I'd love to. That is definitely something that I'd like to do in the future. Like I'd love to have a store where we actually have a shop that resoles the shoes there. That would be incredible. So that's kind of like that's the future project.
Well, I think it speaks to the quality right out of the gate of your shoes that you don't, haven't had a lot of need for it yet because they're so well made to begin with.
And the few that we have, we've actually resold them for them. So we will take them to, there's a really, really great cobbler in Los Angeles that does an incredible job, and he does all the resoling. So
That's great. So your shoes all have a Miss or a Mister name to them. How do you name these shoes?
they're people I meet, they're circumstances. I mean, they're moments in time. They're me overhearing a conversation between like two people on a train in London and just going, oh, that's a great conversation, and remembering that name and going, okay, I'm definitely naming, like, or I'll see somebody with great style, I'll ask them what their name is and I'll name it after them. So there's a lot of like hidden little gems like that. I might tell those stories more often, but there's hidden gems like that where I might see somebody because of the way their style is, or because of their interaction with people, or something, the way they carry themselves, and I might name a shoe after them because of that, you know? And then there's like a little quirkiness in there and a little punch. Like, we named one after Ryan Gosling because he always wears a certain like men's boot, and we made a woman's version of it. So, there was the Mr. Ryan that we had for a while. I have friends that I have shoes that are named after them because of that's the type of shoe they wear. So,
It'd be fun. And now we'll get to this, but I now have my first pair of Angela Scott shoes and I love them. But it would be fun when you got them if there was a little, like one paragraph or two paragraphs about how the shoe was named.
right? You know what we thought of too is how cool would it be is if like you could scan, because everybody's so digital now, scan that and it like had the person on there being like, I'm, Neil Harris, and the Harrison is named after me, because like the Harrison is named after my friend Neil, and
Right.
it'd be kind of cool. But so that's definitely something that we were thinking about doing.
Yeah, that would be kind of
Naming
fun.
conventions
I
are fun,
always do.
and as we go on, like, we've also started trying to incorporate some historical figures, like the Schweitzer sneaker is named after a very like one of the very first women who ran in a marathon. They like tried to like physically push her out of the marathon, like physically make it so that she couldn't run this marathon as a woman. So that was super fascinating to me, and I wanted the sneaker, like our first running sneaker, to really be named after somebody who has this incredible, historical feat that she overcame. So
Well, and I think I'm an artist myself, and I have collected some art. And when my home burned in 2007 in the fires here in California, and as I rebuilt my new home, I was very intentional about it. I was very on purpose about it. And so as I was picking the design and picking things to be in my home around me, I always wanted to understand the story behind what I was picking out. The stone, what's the story? Where did that come from? What, how about the painting? What's the story of the artist? How did they come up with the idea? These shoes, how did these shoes, because these shoes really are a piece of art, I have to say. So I think you have something there for the future if you wanted to jump on board and use the names and the stories behind them for sure. Let's talk about the women who buy your shoes. You told me in a previous conversation that we had that you had gotten a text from a woman who had been a Angela Scott shoe participant. And it was very touching to you because she was in the hospital with her husband who was having heart surgery. Tell us a little bit about her and the other women who wear your shoes.
yeah, so it's interesting when you start a company, especially when it comes to a product, you don't realize what kind of community you're building. And as this company, even in the early years, it wasn't because of fame or familiarity, or it was like right off the bat. It was in the first few years that people, it maybe because I'm casual and there's a sense of familiarity, so once you meet me, it feels like family, because everybody I meet, like, they become part of my family. But a lot of the women have become my friends. Like, a lot of our clients are now my good friends, my friends. And it was interesting because, there was this woman who wears our shoes. She's incredibly great style. I thought she was an influencer. She actually works for the government. She's an incredible woman. We had lunch, and then she started going through these hardships. And I showed up for her in a way that I tried to be there and cognizant of what she was going through. But it was also like I felt so honored for somebody to reach out to me and to express what they're going through. That's not an easy thing to do, but it also made me realize like we as business owners, as women, as entrepreneurs, we have kind of a responsibility to show kindness and to show humanity. And now having these friends, these women that are my clients that are now friends, it's really fascinating because I want to show up for them as more than just, oh, you buy my shoes. Like,
Right.
that's not enough for me. Like, that doesn't seem right. Like, I want to know you. I want to know who you are and what you're about. And I want to be there to support you when you're going through something like this, right?
Yeah, and I saw, I think it was this week, maybe it was last week, where, and I don't know if you're going to continue to do this or not, but you featured a coach, a female coach that was wearing your shoes, and you talked a little bit about her, and those stories are really interesting. I love that.
Yeah. She's the head coach of the San Jose State University, and I went to San Jose State University to talk to the women's basketball team. And but I mean, again, she messaged me on Instagram, like, and it was so funny because she laughs when I got there. Everybody said, "Oh, where are you from?" I said, "Santa Barbara." They said, "You drove all the way down to Santa Barbara?" I said, "Yeah." She asked me to, and they said, "Well, how long have you guys known each other?" I'm like, "Well, she just sent me a message on Instagram." Like, it was literally that fast, but like, that's how I want to show up. If these women are showing up for me by wearing my shoes, by showing me what it means to be like a great leader, I want to show up just the same way. And if I can, I should.
And you also, I want you to speak a little bit. You have a collaboration with a girls organization, a young girls organization. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think it's great at our ages to be able to have that community, but it's really great if we can start them young, I think. The importance of being kind to one another, supporting one another, inspiring one another, and really being there when your friend needs a hand.
Yeah. So we started it at our 10-year anniversary. We made a commitment to donate $100,000 a year to nonprofits that support women and young girls. But on a personal level, I was feeling like I wanted to also be more connected in that way. So we've donated to organizations like Black Girls Code, the Women's Venture Group. Like, we've donated to some really incredible organizations, and one of them was Girls Inc. We've donated to their New York Girls Inc., to the Los Angeles Girls Inc., to Santa Barbara Girls Inc., and we've had externs that come from Carpinteria, young girls that come to the office, and they spend, a couple months learning the business. But I really wanted to make a personal impact, and I'm now on the board of Santa Barbara Girls Inc. But I think it's so important for organizations like that to get visibility, because to be able to be in, it's not an after school program. They're not, it's not babysitting. It's not a babysitter's club. It's actually an organization that teaches these women life skills, like financial skills, how to be, kind and considerate, to be bold, to strong, to stand up for yourself, to understand your physicality, to understand what's going to happen to you as a woman as you get old, like everything. They kind of hit all the sector, and it's really important for me to be involved with those organizations and to learn from them. I learn from these young girls. Like, I am blown away with the fortitude that these young girls have. I mean, I remember I have nieces and I have nephews and I have cousins, and I have never met women, young women like this before, but it is because of that organization. The way they speak, the way that they're so empowered and they're so bold, it's unreal. It's very cool. So it's a really important part.
Yeah, I love that. And I will put the link in the show notes for those organizations as well, because there could be other people out there that would like to add to
Yeah.
the funding
And
of
they're
that.
all over. Girls Inc. is huge. They're in every state. They're incredible organizations.
So if you listeners out there are interested in being a volunteer or donating some money or time or ideas to these organizations, I think that would be something really good for you to consider. So I will, like I said, put that in the show notes for us. So, Angela, what's next for the brand? Do you have belts or purses or hats or
You know, I want it all. No, it's interesting because I think that there's a lot more road ahead of us as far as like the diversity of types of shoes that we do. So I think there's still a lot more footwear to come, but I do think that there's a natural extension of like accessories and leather goods and things of that nature. I would love to get into the world of like what kind of tools, because if we could be a brand that is the resource for women, like we have gotten so many messages from women that are like, I gave myself a pair of shoes because I got this raise, or I just graduated college and I got a pair. I asked my mom to get me a pair of your shoes for my first job. There's a lot of women empowering themselves when they reach their accomplishments through our brand. So I would love to like add more tools, more things that are business related or that surround that ecosystem that could be smaller, that could be giftable, that are these things that are, I accomplished something, so I'm gonna buy one of these, or that would also encourage women to buy it for each other. 'Cause we celebrate each other when we get married, when we get pregnant, when it's our birthday. But what about when we get a raise?
Yeah.
Like, what about when we get a new job? What if we got fired and we found a new job? How about empowering each other in those circumstances?
Yeah.
So something that would be a good, extension of that would be really, really fun.
Yeah, because you could, if one of your friends got a raise or started a company or whatever accomplishment they had, and they already have a pair of your shoes, you could say, here's a badass belt to go with those badass shoes.
Exactly.
Because you're a
Exactly.
badass.
Exactly.
They will
Exactly.
call one of the belts a badass. Okay, this, as I told you guys, this was going to be an empowering, inspiring conversation, and it is. And it's everything I knew it would be, Angela. So thank you. Let's move into some more leadership type territory here, or CEO territory, if you will. What's contributed to your success as a CEO?
I think the biggest part is really listening to my team, understanding. I think that as a leader and having an opinion, I think that those are two things that are really difficult to do, is having a direct opinion, knowing exactly what you want, but also allowing your team to facilitate that. And they're going to fail. They're never going to do it exactly how you want, especially as an entrepreneur, especially running a business in the beginning. Nobody is ever going to do it the way that you do it. So having that empathy and understanding that there's going to be failure, but there's also going to be learning, like that's also like builds learning and experience, and you'll get to a certain point where it'll balance out. And I think giving autonomy to people to let them feel empowered by what their position is. I'm sometimes maybe too much of this, but I like to get everybody's opinion involved. I like everybody to understand what's going on in all the departments. So if you're in customer service, although you're answering phone calls and emails, you should also be able to be involved in what new colors are coming for the season, or what's happening in the operations, or what's getting launched on the website. Those are all integral. So I think also building a community where people aren't siloed into one single job facet, that everybody knows all parts of the company in some way, shape, or form, so that they're just better involved and there's more of a feeling of an understanding of the brand as a whole.
Yeah, because somebody in the warehouse or in the shipping department might have the best idea for the color for a new pair of shoes. You never know. Might
Exactly.
put all the good heads
It's true.
together.
It's
Right.
very true. It's so true. Yeah.
So, in your experience and also your observation, what do you think are some of the challenges that female leaders face these days?
Ooh, it's so tough. I think female leaders can be their worst enemies sometimes, because I think that, I think a lot of times, I experienced it in the discovery of what I wanted to do. When I started reaching out to female leaders that I knew about wanting to start a brand, I got a lot of pushback. I didn't get a lot of support, like none. I did get support from some men. It's saying, go for it, go do it. But I didn't get it from the women. I got, no, you should just go get a good job that pays you well. And I got, no, you wouldn't want to start in that industry, it's too expensive. But I didn't get any, what can I do? How can I help you? Let's get this going. And I think that that's one of our biggest challenges, is that even though our plate may be full, and we may be crawling and scratching to get up to the top in our own journey, you should still reach out that hand in any way, shape, or form that you can to that other woman that's also venturing her own way, whether it's in the corporate world or in the entrepreneurial world. Because when we help more get to the top, it's just going to be better for us all. So I think one of the biggest challenges I've had is not having the support of other women business owners or women entrepreneurs or women executives to support my journey.
Yeah, I think you're so right about that. And I think that's one thing that we could learn a lot from men. Men, they get together
Oh,
and they're like, hey, you go,
boys
buddy.
team.
Let's go come to my garage. We'll get this all sorted out this weekend. Let's go have a beer. We'll talk this through. We'll get this. Let's go. And
And
it's
oh, you went bankrupt? No problem. We'll start again
let's
next
start
week.
again.
No
Yeah,
problem.
exactly. And women are, it's almost feels a little bit like they don't want you trolling on their territory, or they're protective, or there's just a little bit of an edge about that. So I think it would be really great if we could expand our willingness to learn from the fellows out there who really are masterful at this, helping each other out.
I think it's the obstacle is the way. I think a lot of women look at the obstacle as the problem and it's the way because they look at the obstacle as like, ooh, I had to work so hard to get up here. If I help you up, what if they let me go because they only want one woman up here,
Yeah.
right? Instead of going, I'm going to get you up here because then you're going to bring two others with you and then we'll be five up here. So they can't get rid of all of us because now we're five, you know? So I think that it's looking at the obstacle as if it's the way versus the obstacle.
Yeah, we'll run the whole show and we'll get jackets to go.
Let's do it. Exactly.
Okay, you once again in it was either an Instagram post or on LinkedIn, you mentioned that your 46th birthday was a turning point in your life. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think I was 46. I was still working another job. So I was doing the company and I was still working another job. And I really wasn't taking any time for myself. I had built this really great company. I felt like I had gone through some obstacles as everybody does as being a CEO and an entrepreneur, is that you go through different changes of employees and restructuring. And as you get bigger, you go from, having a scrappy team that has no experience to going, okay, well, we're at a certain point where we need some, more people with bigger experience. And I realized that I had finally gotten to that stage where I had the right team. The business was doing incredibly well. I mean, I'm lucky to say that like year over year, this company has been profitable. Like every year has been an increase from the year before. We've never had a down year. And it's a little bit of my conservative like approach, but it's also, just being really smart about the business and having a great team. That's a big part of it. But I was sitting there at my 46th birthday going, is this what I'm going to do for the rest of my life? Just work to live? Like, I'm just working. I'm working two jobs. I'm constantly working. And I love working. Like, I love contributing. I love feeling like I'm adding value, but I'm not living. And that was a big wake up call. It was like, I need to start living and I need to start taking care of my health. I mean, my hair was falling out. I was a disaster. So you'd look from the outside and you go, oh, she's got everything. Big company, success, the shoes look great, it's profitable. But like if you met me in person, you'd be like, you look exhausted, you're tired, your hair is falling out, I was stressed, and I don't know why. Like I was just overwhelmed. And so I took a big step back, and I am so thankful for it because it really made me understand that like a 2-hour walk in the morning is necessary.
Yeah.
It's not just like, oh, it's if I can get it in, it's necessary. And if it's raining, then I'm doing some kind of workout for 2 hours here or stretching in my house. Like these moments, these times, putting on a mask, like start ending the day at 4:30. Like, whatever that may be that makes me feel like I'm getting peace. I started cooking. I've never cooked in my entire life. Never. And now I cook and I love it. But like giving myself the ability to go, you don't have to prove yourself anymore.
Right.
Like you've done enough, you're good enough. Now just, don't kill yourself for it.
Yeah, and I think until we get in the habit before it becomes more habitual for us, we have to calendarize our stillness and our exercise and our self-care. It's a meeting. It's that
Yeah,
2 hour
it's a
walk in
meeting.
the morning is a meeting. That quitting it, that stopping the the office of Angela Scott at 4:30 in the afternoon is a meeting, because you have a meeting that you're going to go create some new dish that you're excited about trying.
Yeah, exactly. And feeling not guilty for it.
Yes.
You know, I think a lot of this time I felt guilty. I felt guilty to quit my other job because I was doing that job because I felt responsible for it and I was good at it. And like, I felt guilty for leaving that. I felt guilty for leaving the office early. I felt guilty for, you know, not being there on the weekend and putting extra time in. Like it was a little bit of guilt. I don't know why. It's so strange, but like, you know, it was a little bit of that. Like, I felt like I needed to be there 24/7. If I wasn't, then I wasn't giving it my all.
I think that's not unusual, particularly for women, because, you know, women are, you're a mom and you're a spouse and you do the dishes and you cook the food and you have the job and you've got all these hats that you're wearing, and you feel guilty if you're not doing one of those roles. And our roles is in our essence. So we have to really be mindful of, no, there's time for everything and it'll all get done. And, you know, I think there's probably not anyone listening that would say, on my deathbed, the first thing I'm going to be saying is, man, I wish I'd have spent a whole lot more time at the office.
It's true. It's so true, right? And I was thinking, 46, Angie, you're almost 50, like you're halfway there. Like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Wake up, go camping. I bought a truck, and then I bought a camper that I can put on the back that I can go sleep in the little mattress. That, like, I want to adventure now. Like, it's like, I want to adventure before I can.
Good for you. That's great. Okay, we're almost done. A couple more questions for you. You use your visualization a lot to consider your future. How do you do that? And can you give us something that you're currently visualizing that you're looking forward to actually seeing it come into fruition?
Yeah. So I do it every morning. Like, I practice, I do a little bit of, you know, like, I wake up quite early. I'd say that my walks are a bit of that manifestation. So during my walks, I'll kind of, you know, I do this, it's going to sound funny, but I do this like guides of the highest truth and compassion, you know, and then I'll kind of say what I'm thinking of in the moment and what I'm manifesting for the future. A lot of it is like just making sure that I'm putting out my gratitude of what I'm grateful for. Even if it's the smallest things, I'm grateful for the smell of the, you know, the sky after it rains, but like, putting out that gratitude, but then also manifesting what I want to see in the future. And I think it's really important that, for me at least, the way I manifest is I'm already there, because what I'm looking at is my future self. So I talk in the present tense. Yes. and I write down, because I not only do this during the walk, but then when I get home, I journal it and I write it down in a journal. And I talk about it as if it is in existence, because I'm looking at my future version of myself. So, you know, some of the things that I'm manifesting right now is that I really want, you know, I want to be on a couple of boards. Like, I'd really like to do that. I want to have an impact in women's life in a bigger way. I want to speak to women around the world about empowerment and entrepreneurship and being a CEO. So those are things that I'm writing down. Like, I am speaking to women across the country. Like, I am on the board of this company. I am, you know, and those are things that I'm manifesting right now, because I think it's really important that once you start manifesting that, you'd be surprised at how it all falls into place, because you're actively encouraging yourself while you're manifesting to look for that and to build towards that.
I do that too. And what you just mentioned for yourself is, I want to be on boards. I see myself sitting in that boardroom in the chair, what I'm wearing, who's next to me, what pen I'm writing with,
yeah.
what my, you know, my notebook looks like, or I see myself walking across stages with a microphone or whatever they give you to give your talk with. And it really is powerful that you are standing in that right now. What it feels like, what it looks like, what it tastes like, what it sounds like, what it smells like, all that. And if you can get yourself in that state, it's on its way, because you've raised your vibration to attract it to you. So it's bound to happen. I love that so much. Okay, let's end with this. If you were to spend the day with someone you didn't know, how would their life be different by the end of the day?
How would their life be different because of me? I would say if somebody were to spend the day with me, they would definitely, I think that they would have a higher heightened sense of themselves. I'm very much a giver. Like I'll give an example is I spent the day with somebody I'd never met before. She reached out through me to me through LinkedIn. She's a photographer. She's an incredible woman. She basically moved to a whole new city in a whole new community, and she's had a pretty tough life, and she's had an incredible career, and was at the end of the conversation, she said, "How do you allow yourself to feel so confident about yourself?" And I said, "It's not that. It's like, how do you not see yourself as the woman you are?"
There you go.
She didn't see the woman that she was right in front of her. So if you're going to spend a day with me, I can guarantee you that you're going to walk away knowing who you are and knowing your value. Because that's what I want to give, and that's what I want to be. I don't want to be somebody who's just going to talk about myself. I want to know you. I want to know why you're doing it. I want to know where you want to go. I want to know how you want to get there. And can I be of any service? And that's what you'll have with me, is you'll have an engagement like that. And you'll probably laugh a lot because I'm quite goofy and horribly awkward and uncomfortable, and will probably spill something or knock something off of a table. So you'll also get a good laugh.
There you go. I love that. And for all those future days you're going to be spending with people, they are very fortunate.
Oh,
Very, very fortunate.
thank you.
You are truly a beautiful, bold, brave, badass, and keep doing what you're doing. And thank you for all that you have done. And as I said, I will put all of this information in the show notes as far as the links that you can follow along with Angela on social media and the charities that are the organizations that she's involved with. And I hope for all of you listening, this was as informative and as inspiring as it was for me to you, because this was a great conversation, especially for women, especially for entrepreneurs. I think even men who listen to this, and I think that a lot of men can tend to feel a little beat up sometimes, but I think what I heard you say today is there's wonderful men out there who are supportive and your mentors and can help you along and answer questions. So take advantage of all the resources that are available to us in the world every single day.
Yeah, definitely.
Any parting words before we go, Angela?
My parting words would be is that if you're out there and you want to start something on your own, and if you're looking to change careers or start a career or start a company, go speak to your community. Go reach out. Do not be afraid. You're not a bother. You're not going to be in the way. Reach out to your community. Reach out to women. And if you don't even know them, reach out anyway. That's even better, because you're going to be a bolder, more badass version of yourself.
Yeah. And the ones who say no weren't meant to be in your journey. And the ones who say yes will have an incredible impact on you.
100%.
Thank you so much, Angela. I really appreciate it.
So lovely.
Yeah. We'll stay in touch. And all you listeners out there, go listen to this a couple times. You'll get gems out of it every single time you do. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye. That's a wrap on this episode of the Badass Soul Seeking Warrior podcast, where we focus on creating a life that we love. And until we meet again, stay true and be you.